Good morning. Now with amplification. Okay, so hopefully you're here for CS3330, computer architecture. We're going to be talking about how computers work, how the hardware part of computers works. So we're going to be going further down the layers of abstraction, closer and closer to hardware. And sort of the highest level we're going to start at is a higher level language. And for this class, we'll consider C high level, even though in most of your other classes, you probably would say it's not a high level language. And we're going to be using C a bit. We're not actually going to be doing that much C programming, but the reason we're using C is, well, one, you kind of already know it. You've taken 2150. C is almost a subset of C++, and you probably did a bunch of C++ in 2150, and you did a little bit of C proper, and it's simpler than C++. And for this class, well, we don't actually really care about programming in C that much. We'll do a little bit. What we care about is that it has this kind of direct correspondence to assembly. That means that there's a way, if you look at C code, there's a very straightforward, mechanical way to translate it to assembly in most cases. And often, I'm going to want to like talk about what we're having a processor do, and I'm going to want to show code, and well, I could show you assembly, but it probably would be easier to understand something more like C code. So, you know, because you can do that manual translation if you want to, so it's just easier to show C to like think about something that's a little easier to have in your head than a bunch of assembly. And because of this direct correspondence, you know, it's easy to look at C and talk about sort of how we would execute it on our actual hardware when we're talking about how we're going to build that hardware. Now, this might give you the impression that, oh, so that means we're going to learn how, if I write a particular piece of C code, I'll understand what the hardware is doing to run it. Just by looking at the C code, I can kind of do that translation directly. And, well, I said there is a direct correspondence. This direct correspondence might not be the one your compiler chooses. So we're going to use C because there's a way of taking C into assembly that, you know, is very straightforward. But compilers are often written to produce fast code, and sometimes the fastest thing to do is not this straightforward mechanical translation. So for example, if you see plus equals in a C program, you would think naturally that would translate to an add instruction. And often it will. But the compiler might decide, oh, there's this faster way I can do that, and we'll do something else. That's kind of an issue we're going to kind of ignore. So we're using C as sort of a shorthand for assembly, but beware that your compilers might not view it that way. They might view it as, I'm going to do whatever weird, clever things that aren't straightforward to produce the most efficient assembly from this, even if it's not what you would look at this and translate it to assembly, like going line by line. So questions about this idea of C corresponding to assembly? And for that reason, we're going to have assignments where we need something like a C environment for later in this class, and just a generally a Unix-like environment for a bunch of assignments later in this class. And the officially supported way is department accounts. If you were registered yesterday, you should have one. For people who are registering late, I will deal with sending them more lists later this week. And this will give you remote access to SSH and to Portal and X, and this is a suitable way of accessing the department machines. The thing that's listed as the lab for this week is just getting this working, basically. The physical lab will not be staffed. You're welcome to go to the room, but no course staff will be there. So, but if you want to hang out there, we're not going to stop you. So there's instructions off the course website for, you know, this week's lab. And For assignments in general, the officially supported environment is department machines via remote access. Often, people have good luck using their own environments, and you're welcome to do that, but you know, if I'm at office hours and you're asking me how do I get a Linux VM working for this assignment, and there's three people waiting, I'm gonna tell you we're gonna get you working on the department accounts rather than me debugging the Linux VM on your machine while three people are waiting. So that's our sort of officially supported environment for assignments. And the lab for this week, there's no one actually physically in lab, but let's get that working, and you can ask for help in office hours, Piazza, whatever. We'll talk about that. You're getting help more later if you have trouble. And as I said, if you were registered yesterday, you should have an account. Okay. So I talked about C. So I mentioned C has this direct correspondence to assembly, and assembly sort of has a more direct relationship to sort of what actually happens on the machine. And in theory, you've seen assembly before, and we're gonna use the same type of assembly that you've theoretically seen before, well, kind of, which is x86 64 assembly, 64-bit x86 assembly. And in theory, you all know this from 2150. Now, I've taught this course a bunch before, and I know better than to assume that everyone kind of remembers all their assembly from 2150. So we're gonna do some review. Also, our textbook and my slides here use AT&T syntax, the other assembly syntax, so we're also gonna talk about that. So you can actually read that version. Now, we're not gonna actually be doing much assembly programming. The primary reason we want you to know assembly is to read assembly, because we want to talk about what processors are doing. We want to look at assembly, which is sort of what the processors are running. And if you don't understand what it's supposed to do, that's gonna make things difficult. So we want you to be comfortable with that. And that, in fact, is gonna be our first assignment. Now, as I said, in theory, you know, so let's do a little check here. So here, I have a little C function. I have three global variables, X, Y, and Z, and just adds them together and returns the result. And I have two assembly versions of this, potentially, or maybe not. And the question is, which, if any, of these are correct translations of that C function? So why don't you, I would check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what's going on here. And if you think something is an incorrect translation, a good question is, what does it do instead? You can talk to your neighbors, I'll give you a minute or two. Things going on here. And I have both the Intel syntax version, which you're probably more familiar with, and the AT&T syntax version. And as far as I know, that is the correct AT&T syntax version for the Intel syntax and vice versa. Like, that's not where there's any problems. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is your best answer? Okay. B, C, D. Okay, so we have mostly B and a few D's and a very small number of A's. Okay, so anyone with D want to tell me what's wrong with both of them? Yes. Okay, so you're saying, wait a moment, we're using the address of those variables instead of the actual value. So this is a question about what does it mean when we have just a name of something in assembly? What does that actually mean? And that's a good question. And the usual convention, which is not intuitive, is that these are global variables. So these are basically going to be declared somewhere in assembly as we have x, you know, and, you know, some initial value, right? And when we're thinking of setting the variable x, we're setting actually the value in memory at that location. And then the question is, so what does x represent? And typically x represents a memory address here. So x is the sort of a placeholder for the address of x. And this is something that in 2150 we don't go over very well, so we're going to talk about that a little later, about what labels are, what names in assembly, what they mean. And the short answer is that, you know, you kind of think of them, oh, they represent like a variable or a function, but in assembly what they correspond to is the address. And we'll learn that in the process of converting the assembly to machine code, what's going to happen is that we're going to basically replace those instances of like x or get sum with the address that was chosen for x or get sum. So that is in fact not a problem, but it's not something that we've actually really gone over in 2150. It's why we're going to talk about it in the next few days. That's your question? So some other things you could have found that would have made you choose D that would be also reasonable. Any other reasons people wanted to choose D that might want to volunteer? But yeah, one thing is like, what does it mean to have a label? And yeah, the convention for global variables is that they represent, the label would be the address of the variable, so it wouldn't be a problem. But, you know, we didn't actually show where X was declared, so you couldn't really know that. But there's something else that couldn't be an issue here. Okay, no volunteer. So there's one thing here, which is that RAX is 8 bytes. I should take my time. This is 8 bytes. And this value on the machines we use, not all the machines, but is 4 bytes. So that seems like a mismatch here. So probably, you know, really to match these assemblies, it should be long. Does it actually matter? Well, you know, if we compute the 8-byte value, probably the bottom 4 bytes of it are the same as if we used 4 bytes. So it probably doesn't change the result, but given that all these values are using RAX and not EAX, using an 8-byte value, if we're thinking of C on Linux, you know, we'd expect it to be a long value, not a name value. So that's a good reason you could have chosen D, is you said, wait a moment, why are we turning an int in, but it's an 8-byte value. Okay, so otherwise, I think, other than that issue, I think B is the best answer. So B here. In fact, this x, y, and z represent the address of the global variable x, y, and z. That's sort of what we generally do in assembly, and usually how we have x, y, and z declared in the assembly file is sort of representing the address of them. And what we do is we take the address of X, we access memory at that location, put it in RAX, then we add the value of memory at the address of Y to RAX, the value of memory in address C to RAX, and so on. So that's what B does. So what does A do? What is the second instruction in A do? How would we describe, what would that look like in C? What kind of operation would this add RAX, RAX plus Y, or add Y parentheses RAX comma RAX, if we're using AT&T syntax. What would that, what sort of operation would that be if it were C code? So then, yeah, or alternately, mechanically, like how would we describe that second instruction? What does it do? Anyway. Yeah?
It's gonna try to take whatever memory is stored at the address from
Okay, so it's gonna, we're gonna make an address by combining the value in RAX and the Y, which we learned that these global variables we're gonna represent in assembly as their addresses. So we're gonna combine those values and then get a memory address from that. Yeah, so that's what's gonna happen. So the question is, look, what does that make sense in C? Is there anything in C which would look like that? And there is something in C which kind of looks like that, which is an array access. So basic, a way we can look at that instruction is that it's basically using Y as the start of an array and using RAX as basically a type of index into that array. So we could write C code which will produce assembly like that, but that's not what we have. So the second instruction is kind of like doing, you know, if Y was an array of longs, RAX gets Y at index RAX divided by the size of a long, so divided by 8 on x86, 64, Linux. So this is here. This is kind of like Y of RAX divided by 8. If Y were an array instead of just a single value. So questions on that sort of interpretation? So I have my summary of what the instructions do. So we have our move, and then X represents the address of X, so this move from memory at the address of X into RAX. And in the correct answer, we had add RAX and plus memory in the address of Y, and the same for Z. So that produced our correct value. And in the incorrect answer, we took RAX added to memory at RAX plus the address of Y, which we said was that array lookup. And I guess something else that we didn't go over, but seems like everyone was comfortable with, is that we have a calling convention. So when we return something, we have to know where does it get returned to. And the convention we're going to use on 64-bit Linux with x86 is that it goes into RAX or some smaller part of RAX. And that's why we're writing into RAX, not some other register or some memory location. Because that's just where whoever's calling gets some is going to expect the return value. Questions about this example? All set. So that's a little about assembly. A little refresher. So we're going to have some first assignments on assembly later on. We're going to review some things that, like labels, that we, you know, weren't really covered in much detail in 2150. So we're also going to talk about machine code. And if you look at this picture, you might say, wait a moment. So assembly, we're using x86-64. What's this y86 thing for machine code? And y86 is our textbook subset of x86. And they have their own machine code that they invented from scratch that's not the real x86-64 input. You might say, why are we using this fake machine code instead of the real one? And the reason is that the real x86-64 machine code, I could teach it, I've taught it for other classes before, but it has a bunch of things which just aren't very interesting to us and are complicated. And the reason is that, well, there was a processor that was 16 bits, and then they converted that to a 32-bit processor in the next version, and then later on, AMD converted the 32-bit processor to a 64-bit processor, and in each of these steps, they decided, oh, I want to keep the machine code mostly the same. And because of this, the machine code has a bunch of complicated things that are just because of this sort of history of it originally being for a machine with 16-bit values and fewer registers, but trying to keep most of the same machine code format. And we could learn all that stuff, but it's not really interesting, so we're going to use our textbooks machine code, which is simpler. Also, we're going to have you, in a simulator, build a processor that can run machine code. And for running machine code, it sure is nicer if it only is a subset of the instructions. So that's going to keep things simpler. That's why we're going to use that, rather than trying to have you implement actual x86-64 and way more instructions. You know, if you're writing, you know, assembly or machine code, yeah, you want all the instructions. If you're implementing it, you probably don't. Now, the machine code we're going to be using is still not super simple. So it's going to have, you know, things that weren't in IBCM, which you may or may not remember from 2150. You know, we're going to have a variable length encoding. We're going to have lots of registers. We're going to have lots of conditional jumps and flow control, and we're going to still have some stack manipulation instructions, those push and pop instructions, to worry about. Some questions about our machine code choices. Okay. So, machine code, that's, you know, the raw thing the machine runs, but we actually want to go to implementing that. And I have at the bottom sort of how we implement things. We implement things out of transistors, out of things you might recall from other courses of like gates and registers and wires. And we're going to talk about those some, but for the most part, we're going to have this extra layer of abstraction on top we'll call a hardware design language. So kind of like, you know, when we're writing programs on a software, you know, you don't write software in machine code. No one really does that. We write in these higher level languages, which get translated to machine code somehow. And the same sort of thing happens in the hardware space. We could describe our hardware by making a diagram of here's where I put all the transistors, and here's where I put all the wires. And at some point, we're going to want that. But that's not really a practical way to build hardware. Instead, we want to have some sort of programming language for it. And that programming language, since it's for hardware, it's not going to compile down to machine code. It's going to compile down to that sort of description of what physically, what hardware we would build. And, you know, we could do this in a way where we're like, we have to draw things, you know, and we've actually done that in prior versions of courses, but most of these hardware description languages are programming languages very much like the programming languages we used before. You write some sort of text file, and there's some translation of that text file to the underlying thing we'll execute. Now, for our exercises, we're going to have a simulator, but the idea is that sort of the industrial versions of this, instead of getting just a simulator, you'd also get sort of a description of here's how you physically build the processor. And that's what you take to build a processor. Now, we're going to be using our own homegrown hardware design language called HCLRS, which is based on a hardware design language called HCL in our textbook. And this doesn't actually have an implementation which compiles down to physical hardware, but it's very similar to some real industrial hardware design languages like Verilog, which, for which that is done routinely. And this is the level we'll be dealing with. And at this level, just like, you know, in a normal programming language, most of the time you don't need to worry about like what's a memory address. Like, we're not going to worry about details of like how do we arrange transistors to like add values together. That's going to be abstracted away from us. And a bunch of other details. We're going to worry about sort of higher level design decisions, just like in a you know, a programming, normal programming language, you're like, you don't worry about where all my variables stored. That's the compiler's job, and we're going to have a compiler whose job it is to worry about a bunch of those hardware details. So questions about hardware description languages generally? Okay, so I mentioned following our textbook, and I should say for the hardware description language stuff, that's where we're really following this textbook. That's why I had it as required. I would strongly recommend having access to it. I'm not like going to assign textbook problems, but we're going to follow it really closely for those hardware description language assignments, and a lot less closely for everything else. Okay, so we're talking about building processors, and so we're talking about what do the processors actually do? What are processors actually? So here, I have a processor, and if you have a computer, sort of the most important things, from our perspective, is a processor, or a central processing unit in this case, just where the processor is, and memory. And I have here some physical pictures. I have a picture of a board with a bunch of chips that hold for memory that you could plug into some types of machines, and I have a microscope photo of a processor. So if you've seen a physical processor, typically they're in some sort of case which hides this. But if you take that off and take a microscope photo, this is the sort of thing it would look like. This is an old one. You can see we have a bunch of regular patterns. We'll learn later on in the semester that these are probably caches, along with these. And over here is something which like does actual like addition, multiplication, and so on. And in our computer, our processor and memory are connected via some two-way communications channel, which I'll call a memory bus. There's multiple ways we could connect these. We'll just call whatever the connection is a memory bus. So let's talk about what happens with them. So we have our connection, and our processor, it has some storage in it. So one thing it has storage for is what we call the program counter, or you might have called the instruction pointer. So we have to know, what instruction are we executing right now? So I'm going to have a program counter, and it's going to store some sort of value. And in this example, I'm just saying the program counter currently has the value 4043x. And the processor is going to look at that program counter and say, OK, that's where the instruction I need to execute is. But it doesn't actually store the values in memory. The memory is separate. And that's a memory address. So what's it going to do? It's going to use this two-way communications mechanism, this memory bus. Ask the memory, hey memory, what's the value at 4043? And the memory is going to reply back and give it the value there. And here I've represented the value as, you know, sort of the assembly, but in practice this would actually be the machine code. I'm not showing the machine code here just because that's not particularly useful to us. But that's what the processor would actually get. So the processor gets this machine code for this instruction. In this case, this instruction in Intel syntax would be move, move RAX, 42. So it writes the value 42 to RAX. And we're getting this instruction, this makes us realize, wait a moment, we need some more things in our processor. So our processor, we need to know what RAX is, and the way we're going to deal with that is RAX is going to be stored on the processor itself, so we're not going to go to the memory to get the value of RAX. We're going to have what we'll call a register file with the values of all these registers that you're used to using in assembly. And so after getting this machine code, the processor is going to update the register file to say RAX is now 42. Okay, so questions about the process so far? Okay, so now we're done running the instruction we have now. We need to go on and keep going. So what are we going to do after we run this move instruction? We're not just going to stop. The move instruction doesn't explicitly tell us what to do next, but we have sort of a default that I think of having an assembly program. You know, if I run one instruction in my assembly program, what happens next is I run the following instruction. So the processor needs to do that. We say after a move instruction runs, the next instruction should run. Where's the next instruction? Well, it's going to be the next thing in memory. So the processor is going to say how much machine code was the move instruction. It's going to add that to the program counter. So in this example, I'm saying it's a bunch of bytes, which is why we went from 4.3 to 4A in the program counter. And that's our new program counter. And we're going to repeat the process. So now we have a different instruction to run. And we're going to ask the memory again, hey, what's that 404A? And the memory is going to give us, oh, it's this instruction, this push RAX. So this is an instruction which is going to write RAX to the stack. So how does the processor know where the stack is? Anyone remember from 2150 assembly, how do we know where the stack is? Where on this picture is the processor going to retrieve the stack from? The location of the stack from? Yeah.
On the register, I think it's RSP, it has the memory address location or the start stack.
Yeah, so the processor is going to have a register that has RSP, which is our stack pointer. So that's not the actual stack, but it's the address of the stack, just like the program counter is not the actual instruction we're running, but the address of that instruction. So we're going to use that address, and we're going to say, you know, do something. We're going to push a value on the stack. So, you know, what we'll say is, oh, the stack is FFF8. So I'm going to add to the stack by decrementing that. So I'm going to tell the memory, hey, the thing just under there, I want to add a value, FFF0, right, 42, the value I got from RAX there. So to do this, the processor looked at the value of the stack pointer, the value of RAX, said, oh, based on the stack pointer and RAX, this is where memory needs to be updated. And also, we're going to update the stack pointer to indicate that we modified where the top of the stack is. And after we're done doing that, we're going to move on and keep going. We're going to go to the next instruction. So we're going to increment the add to the program counter to get beyond the push instruction to whatever's next and keep going. So we're just going to run this loop. You know, look at this instruction, do whatever needs to be done. That operation might require talking to the memory some to do something with the memory because we don't have the memory on the processor physically. You know, if we want to change the value in memory from the stack or otherwise, we're going to have to talk to the memory. If we want to read a value from memory, we have to talk to it using this communications. So questions about this sort of overall process, this sort of loop that the processor is executing. We read an instruction, we figure out what that instruction means. Sometimes that might require us reading or writing other things from the memory. Then we go to the next instruction and so on. Okay. So talking about communicating with memory, so my question might be, what's happening in the memory? And the way we're going to view the memory is that the memory is just this big array of bytes. So each byte has an address. And it's just letting us access it by, when we ask for a value, it reads from it. When we send it a value to write, it modifies some of those bytes. So there's one thing we're kind of missing here. So, you know, what have I not shown in this diagram that we need in a computer? So, you know, what I've shown you so far is not actually enough for us to like have a useful computer. So what's something I'm missing? Yeah.
Accumulator.
So you remember an accumulator from IBCM? So in IBCM, the accumulator was basically just a register. And if we want an accumulator here, we could just use something in the register file as it. So for example, I could just decide arbitrarily, I'm going to call RCX the accumulator, and I could just use it like that. So we're not missing that sort of thing. I indeed did not show all the registers, so you don't know what all them are, but we have space for them at least. So that should be at least very easily solved by just writing more things in the register. Yeah?
Are you talking about different components to do operations?
Different components to do operations. So you mean, I didn't display how the CPU actually does arithmetic, right? So that is something I didn't show in this diagram, but it is something we need. Yes. I kind of left it implicit how the CPU is actually like parsing the instruction and actually doing any additions, multiplications, and so on, but we're gonna have that. There's something that's kind of more fundamental that we're missing on this picture. Yeah?
Inputs and outputs.
Inputs and outputs, that this computer I have here, if I want to like figure out what's happening, I need to figure out what values are in the memory. If I want to, you know, I can't type something, I can't see it on the screen, I have to like look at what values are going to the memory. That's the only way of communicating with this processor. And that's not very useful. Like, maybe we could make that work, but that's not really what we think of as a computer. A computer is going to have some access to input and output devices of some sort, or else it's not very useful. Like, if it's only communicating with this memory, it's hard to figure out what we could do. So we need some way of connecting the memory to the processor. That's not, there's no, nothing shown in this diagram. So one way we can do it is we can say, well, the processor has a way to talk to external things. It talks to the memory. Let's just use that, and we'll attach I/O devices like our keyboards, our displays, to the same communications bus. And in this diagram, I'm deciding to have this component I call an I/O bridge, figure out where to send messages from the CPU, you know, whether it goes to memory or I/O devices. And a way this could work is we could decide that some addresses go to the I/O devices, so some addresses, rather than going to memory, go to the keyboard or go to the display, and some go to memory. And in that case, we don't have to change anything about how a processor works to support the I/O devices. You know, just sometimes when the processor is reading a value from memory, rather than it getting like a number from the stack, it's getting a key press from a keyboard. So questions about this sort of connection of I/O devices? So this is sort of one way of doing it. The design for their textbook kind of takes the approach of like having basically a separate communications line for I/O devices. Both of these are kind of things that real processors do. And the way the separate communications line would work would be very similar to how communicating with memory works, just a separate output and input processor. I think this design, this version with the I/O bridge and one communications layout is probably closer to what current processors do most of the time, but they're both sort of real designs. But the big thing is we need some way of communicating with I/O devices, and a nice trick is that we can use basically the same wet mechanism for sending and receiving values we use with memory to communicate with keyboards and displays and so on. That we already have this way of communicating with external devices, we can just, you know, modify that to support these other devices. Some questions about communicating with I/O devices. Okay, so we've talked about this sort of communication loop. Let's look at this model. And here I have an instruction where I read a value from memory into RAX. My question is, how many times is a message sent from the processor to memory? Yeah, so check with your neighbors to see if you agree on the answer. Give you a minute or so to work out what that should be. Remember, we have this model where we set ask memory things and get responses. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks one or more messages? One or more. Okay. Two or more. Okay, three or more. Four or more. Okay, no clue. Few. Zero. Okay. So it looks like one is our consensus answer. So let's think about what this instruction does. So this instruction, to run this instruction, what we need to do is we need to get the value 123400 from memory and put it in RAX. To get the value from memory, we're going to have to ask the memory, hey, what's at 123400? But there's one other step we need to run this instruction, which is we need to actually get the instruction itself. Remember, the first step for executing each of these instructions is asking, hey, what's the machine code for this instruction so we know what it is? Otherwise, we can't do it. So I count two messages. So the first, we have to say, hey, what's the machine code for this instruction? Only then can we figure out, oh, it's a move. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't know it's a move, we wouldn't know how to run it. Because the processor doesn't actually store the instructions, that's in the memory. So the only way it can get the instructions is by asking the memory for them. So questions about the idea? Other reasons people thought we only had one? Yes?
I kind of assumed that we already had the instruction.
Okay, question, you assume we had the instruction. So, yeah, so definitely after we get the instruction, there's only one step. Yeah. But we don't have storage to, you know, not get the instruction sort of in an obvious way. And so you might say, wait a minute, so our next step was to increment the program counter and then run the next instruction. That's get the next instruction. That's part of the next instruction. So we do have, right after this, this sort of a step we'll do is getting the next instruction's value, but that's not really part of executing this instruction. We're just going to say the step for fetching this instruction and running it is part of executing it. And when we go on to getting the next instruction, that's part of the next instruction. But I could understand if you chose three because you said, wait a moment, you know, we have to go on to the next instruction. That is the thing we'll do, it's just not part of this instruction. So other questions, comments? So I'm going to do a brief interlude on some logistics and some just sort of general things. So a complaint I've gotten about this class is, you know, I'm never building processors. We're talking all about how we build processors. You know, just tell me the minimum I need to do to get my D minus, to get me my BACS requirement. I don't care about this class. I'd like to say there's some things we're going to cover that, you know, should make you care about this class even if you aren't building processors. And because computer engineering majors generally don't take this class, probably most of you aren't. And so there's some things where, you know, we're going to help you understand things by understanding hardware that are useful and things which are very much not making hardware. So one thing is we're going to talk about things which really impact program performance. Knowing how the processor works helps with program performance. And you might say, wait a moment, you know, I learned how assembly works, and I know how to look at assembly generated by my compiler. Isn't that gonna, you know, help me with program performance? And, you know, sort of the way we kind of look at it is you say, oh, you know, I know how many instructions there are, and each instruction takes about one unit of time. I know, like, have a clock rate. That's how fast instructions are. And that's a nice naive model, but that really doesn't work with current processor designs. But if you want to know how fast is my program going to run, yes, knowing what the assembly looks like is helpful, but if you just count instructions, you're going to get an answer that doesn't actually tell you that much about your performance. And there's two big issues that we're going to talk about in this class, which make this sort of idea of one instruction is one unit of time really break down. So one of these issues is parallelism. That modern hardware, especially performance-focused modern hardware, does multiple things at once. So it doesn't just execute one instruction, then the next. I've been showing you that model, and we're going to start out with that model where like we do one instruction, we complete it, then we move on to the next instruction. And that's certainly a way processors have been built, and it's how we're going to sort of talk about processors to start. But you know, sort of current high-performance processors do parts of multiple instructions at the same time. And they need to do that sort of to get their full performance. And you might say, okay, well, why do I need to know that? Don't I just write my program and it runs faster? And well, this is mostly true, but like, for example, you know, if I have to add x plus y plus z, the add x plus y to z instruction, well, it can't run at the same time as the add x plus y instruction. Just because, you know, even if the processor can do two adds at once, it can't do those two adds at once. And things like that are things where you can write your program to make the processor be able to more take advantage of being able to do multiple things at once. Also, we'll learn that there are instructions that are sort of unlike the ones you've seen that processors can provide. So for example, we think of an add instruction as adds two values. Most current processors have instructions that do things like add 16 values at once. And if you can use those instructions, that's probably a lot more efficient. And we'll talk about that. Another big issue beyond parallelism, beyond doing multiple things at once, is caching. So I've been starting us off with the model that every time we want to get a value from memory, we have to talk to this external thing. And that's not actually how processors work, because it turns out talking to the memory is pretty slow. So processors have this smaller, faster storage for things that are recently accessed. And it is, in fact, a lot faster. So if you can write your program to get good use of that smaller, faster storage, it will run a whole lot faster by avoiding sending messages to the memory and waiting for responses to come back. We're going to talk about strategies for doing that and also about how those caches work so we can understand sort of when they perform well and when they perform poorly. And these are both sort of optimization things which are complementary to sort of the performance stuff you learn in other classes. So in most of the other classes we have, we talk a lot about sort of Big O, algorithmic efficiency. And these are things you do on top of Big O. So like you choose the thing that isn't quadratic, but then, you know, if that's still slow, these are the sorts of issues you look at to like use the same algorithm but make it faster. Right. Questions about sort of big hardware things that impact program performance. Okay, so that's one thing you might learn in this class that you care about if you don't care about hardware design. You might say, well, hey, I'm not doing any performance programming. I'm fine writing everything in JavaScript with the JIT turned off. That's fast enough for me. So what else would we care about? So one thing we can use is here is that we're going to talk about how compilers work in some more detail. So you kind of learned a bit of this in 2150, like you saw the assembly generated by compilers. We're going to look a little bit at more of the process of, you know, generating an executable and combining multiple files together. And this might help you make better sense of, you know, weird compiler linker errors, like what does symbols mean in errors and so on. We'll talk about those issues. And also we'll look at sort of issues that affect, you know, what you should do if you make compilers or if you're debugging an application, like what sort of code was the compiler generating and why did it feel like it could do that. So we'll talk about some of those issues. Another thing we'll talk about is when we talk about processors, we're going to talk about how processors deal with weird cases and supporting operating systems. And this is going to have to deal with, you know, odd behavior that you've experienced. So, for example, we're going to talk about what segmentation faults are. So if you've taken 2150, I know there's not a formal assignment on it, but you've probably seen a seg fault. We're going to talk about what seg faults are. We're going to talk about what's going on that explains why sometimes when you access out of bounds, you get a send fault and sometimes you don't. You know, what controls when that happens. And generally about sort of how we make the processor support running operating systems that manage multiple programs. And that's going to be helpful if you're running operating systems or if you're wondering, you know, why does the operating system crash my program sometimes and not other times? You understand sort of the mechanics of what the hardware support going on underneath is. So hopefully this is reason that you might care about this class, even if you don't care about building hardware. Maybe you still don't, but I wanted to explain sort of what our aims are, especially since this is a computer architecture class that, you know, we're not being taken by computer engineers, so presumably many of you are not focused on doing hardware stuff directly, but there's still a lot to learn that should be helpful regardless. Questions about these goals? So let's talk about some general logistics stuff. So I do not take lecture or lab attendance. I think it's probably useful for most people to go to lecture or lab. But I'm not going to check. Lectures are recorded, assuming I don't have technical difficulties. And labs, we allow word and route submission, and that's what we'll be doing for it. If you want to avoid attending lectures, you can figure out what's good for you. I think for most people it doesn't work out great, but it's your decision. If you do that, I recommend having a regular schedule of watching them. Don't like decide, I'm going to watch the lectures before I have to do the assignment that needs them. Usually doesn't work out. I recommend actually pausing and trying to answer lecture questions we ask in lecture. And if you have questions during lecture, write them down and ask them later in office hours or on Piazza. I'm happy to answer for people who are here or aren't here questions about lecture material in my office hours. But you know, don't just assume you're going to, you know, remember the question if you didn't write anything down. So talk about attendance, talk about coursework. So we have labs. Labs are graded in a way where you get full credit if you meet some threshold. The intention is that if you spend 75 minutes working in the lab, almost all the time you should get full credit, but I'm grading what you submit. So obviously, you know, if you submit and nothing works or almost nothing works, you know, I'm gonna look at that and say, did you really spend 75 minutes doing this? No, and sometimes that won't match. But my intention is to mostly give full credit for the labs and partial credit if in the cases where I can't do that. And labs, collaboration is permitted. You can work with whoever you like in the class. That's fine. You can find people in lab, you can find people elsewhere, and they're due by 11:59 p.m. the lab day. But as I said, the intention is that if you work during the lab time, the official lab time, you should get full credit, is the intention. But I'm grading what you submit. I'm not like watching you and having a TA say, were they actually working the lab time? We have homework assignments. Unlike the labs, homework assignments are to be completed individually. Please do not like share code, pseudocode, and so on. You can talk about the topics generally, you know, related lecture material and so on, but they're otherwise to be completed individually. Generally, the homework assignments are sort of introduced by the previous lab, and they're due before the next lab, which means at 9:30, because that's the first lab time, they're due then, because I don't want people asking questions about the prior homework during the lab of my TAs. I want the focus to be on the lab, not the previous homework. We also have weekly quizzes. I'll show what that looks like next time, sort of as far as the interface. They're online, open book, open notes. To be completed individually, but open book, open notes, and released Thursday night, due before the first lecture, which was at 9:30 on Tuesday. And there will be a final. I will decide the format of the final sometime later in the semester. So questions on assignments, generally? Just a note, so labs and homeworks, I've done like the scheduling Tetris, and they should be, you know, mostly close to what we're covering lecture, but, you know, sometimes it might be a week or two off. It might be, we might cover something in lecture and the corresponding homework assignment is like a week or two later, just because, you know, I have to cover it beforehand and topics take different amounts of homework versus lecture time and so on. So yes, we'll show quizzes, a demo on Thursday. Just as a grading out, the two lowest quiz grades are dropped. No questions asked. But the first quiz will be after this week, which is why I'll show you that on Thursday. Light policy. So in general, if you have some sort of illness or other weird circumstance, let me know, preferably as soon as possible, because I have more options the earlier you talk to me to figure out how to make things work for you. But even if you don't talk to me, I have a no questions asked homework late policy. If you submit it 0 to 48 hours late, it's -10%. If you submit it 48 to 72 hours late, it's -15%. If you submit it after that, I'll tell you how you did, but you won't get credit. For quizzes and labs, generally, I will not accept late submissions. Exceptional circumstances, we'll talk about them. Often we can do something, but the reason why I generally won't accept late submissions is that I will often, especially for quizzes and often for labs, release answers. And if I've released an answer, I can't really accept submissions in most cases. Yeah? Question, are quizzes timed? No, quizzes will be untimed. Just do it between Thursday night and Tuesday morning. Other questions? Okay, so for getting help, I expect to use Piazza as the primary non-real-time help form that I will pay attention to. Labs are in person, and you could get help there. Like, we'll prioritize help in the lab, but if you want to ask questions about other things, assuming that there aren't more people to help with the lab right away, the TAs will do that. Office hours will be specified on the website, on a calendar, on the main page of the website. It's not very filled in right now. They have some office hours scheduled for tomorrow. We'll figure out when I and our TAs can be available for the next week or so and start office hours in earnest probably next week. Yes?
So will we start homework next week?
Question, will we start homework next week? The first homework will be assigned after the first real lab next week. Yes?
For labs, can we go to a different section if we want to?
Question, for labs, can you go to a different section if you want to? We're not going to enforce attendance. If the lab is full, we're going to tell people who aren't registered for that lab to go away. So for some labs, this is very unlikely to be an issue, but some of the popular times might be full and might not have an extra capacity in the room. And we might have to tell people, sorry. Did that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Just making sure we don't have to go to lab tomorrow.
Question, we don't have to go to lab tomorrow? Yes. If you, no core staff will be there if you go tomorrow. So office hours, we're planning on a mix of in-person and remote. The tentative plan is that late evening office hours will be remote, and probably Thursday and Friday morning, which are usually low demand times, will be remote via Discord, otherwise in person, at rooms that we will determine after we figure out what rooms we can get at any point in time. There is an online queue which we may use for some office hours, for remote office hours, and some in-person office hours. Generally, in-person office hours should have something written on a whiteboard or something saying, you know, sign up here or use the online queue or something like that. And for smaller office hours, we shouldn't want to use an online queue. If you have an online queue, it's... So ideally, the way an office hour queue would work is that it wouldn't matter how it works, because we have so many people giving you help that you don't wait very long. In practice, that sometimes does happen. So I'm saying the queue is sorted by last time recorded helped. with the first three slots being first come, first served, basically. Just so you aren't surprised for how the online queue works. But so yes, it is not just a straight queue, it has some priority going on. As I said, my hope is that we have enough help that that's not an issue, but I know usually there's sometimes in semesters where it gets contentious and people are like, why is it taking so long? And sometimes it's because you were helped 2 hours ago and everyone else wasn't, you know, or something like that. So questions on sort of office hour stuff? Okay. Okay, and as I mentioned, the first homework will be after the lab next week, which will be doing stuff with assembly. So we're gonna use a debugger, disassembler. We're going to give you a program. You have to find the correct input to the program, but you don't have the real source code, so you're going to need to work from the assembly to figure that out. Okay, so questions on logistics stuff? So let's look at memory in a bit more. So I told you that memory is an array of bytes, and I can draw the array of bytes in one way. And here I've like have byte has an address. And in this class, bytes are always 8 bits. You might know some other places where bytes aren't 8 bits, not in this class. Always 8 bits. And I can draw the memory in multiple ways, and it's the same thing, right? So these are two. The same thing, even though I've put the high addresses on top in one example and on bottom in the other. So it doesn't actually change anything. Now, there is something to deal with here. This is an array of bytes, but when we thought about what the processor is doing, it's like asking for an instruction or a number that's bigger than a byte. And we need to know how that works. And there are two choices, and you learned about this in 2150, but based on my experience, we definitely need to review this. That's endianness. So here, I have some C code where I'm taking the address 42000, making that be the value that's stored in a pointer, and I'm going to print it out. And what's going to happen is I'm going to take the value at 42000, and it's an int, and on the machines we use, int is sort of 4 bytes on x86-64 Linux. So that's going to be 4 bytes. So we take 4 bytes starting at address 42000, and we need to interpret those 4 bytes as an integer. And there's two logical ways to do it. We can have the lowest address be the least significant part or the most significant part. And there are real processors which have made both of these choices. The top choice is called little endian. The bottom choice is called big endian. For this class, we're always going to assume little endian because that's what 64-bit x86 does. Some questions here. And we need to do this because we have a bunch of bytes and I need to know to figure out how to combine them. I need to do something about that. Okay, so we have these two choices. We're always going to do the top one. And the way I remember is the least significant byte has the lowest address. So endianness, I think of always being about the lowest address. And what it is in little is that a little value is where the ones place is. Big endian is it's where the biggest place is. But we always have the ones place there. Okay. So we know about endianness, let's do a little exercise. I'm going to go through the C code. I know it's intimidating. So here, I have a buffer, which I've displayed here. And I have two 32-bit integer values that I've written out in hexadecimal. And I get pointers to those two values. And using those pointers, I'm copying them into a buffer. So I'm copying, going I from 0 to 0, 1, 2, 3. So I'm copying value 1 to buffer 0, 1, 2, and 3. I'm copying value 2 to buffer 4, 5, 6, and 7, so which I've shown up here. So the value 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 goes to the first four slots of the buffer, and value 2 goes through the next four slots of the buffer. But the order in which this happens is based on endianness. Remember, we're assuming little endian, so the lowest address has the least significant part of each of these numbers. Then I'm taking indexes 1, 2, 3, and 4 out of the buffer and putting it back into value 1, byte by byte, using a pointer I have that treats value 1 as an array of bytes. So questions about sort of what this code mechanically does? Okay, so that question is then, what is app value 1 actually going to be? I'll give you a couple minutes. You can check with your neighbors, see if you agree. What's going on? And I guess I would say I would write things down to solve this problem. Maybe you like doing it in your head, but I would feel very uncomfortable not writing things down. Who'd like some more time? Okay, a couple people. so I'm going to ask now so I have enough time to explain things. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, no clue. Okay, so we have a big split here, so we really don't have consensus. So I haven't worked out sort of what's going on slide here. So first thing to think about is that we're copying byte by byte. So I want to know what the bytes of my initial 32-bit numbers are. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hex. How do I split that up into bytes? Well, the least significant byte of that is going to be index 0, the lowest address. The next least significant byte is going to be index 1, and so on. And these are all hexadecimal numbers. Okay, so I do that for value 1 and value 2. Does that make sense? Questions about how I did that? And I'm not splitting up further than bytes. I'm not reorganizing the bytes, because the bytes, we work out at a whole unit. We have no way of saying, give me part 1 of a byte. I can just get the whole byte. So then I do this copying, and I end up copying value 1 to the first part, byte by byte. So index 0 of the bytes of value 1 becomes index 0 of the buffer. And similar for value 2, index 0 of value 2 becomes index 4 of the buffer, then 5 for index 1, and so on. So questions on that process, how we end up with buffer containing this sequence of bytes. So then the next part of the process is to take 1, 2, 3, and 4 and move that back into value 1. So I just copy it byte by byte, but then I'm going to look at it as a 32-bit integer. And when I do that, well, I had to determine, I have this list of bytes, how do I know what number that is? And I use the little endian rule. So the lowest address, index 0, is going to be the least significant part. So this 5, 6 is going to be where our ones place is, and we're just combining the bytes. We take the whole bytes. We don't like reorder things within a byte. That's how I get my answer of F0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, which was G. So questions about that? I know I'm out of time otherwise, so see you on Thursday, and I'll be up here for any after-lecture questions.